So last week, we started this new text called Hymn to Sri Dakshinamurti. Hymn to Sri Dakshinamurti. And last week, I just briefly introduced the text where I mentioned the meaning of the word Dakshinamurti. Dakshinamurti. Murti means the form. The form. So this is a form of the Lord. And in this text, the beauty is that the Lord God Himself is the teacher. He is the Lord and He is the teacher. And the reason we call Him Dakshinamurti, Dakshina means the south, the south. So in our spiritual literature, the south is considered as the world of death. And so we all are living in the south, in the world of death, where there is constant change, birth, death. And the Lord, who is beyond death, who always was, is, and will always be, is considered as being in the north. And He's facing the south. That means He can face death, and we all are afraid of death. It's not only the Lord who becomes immortal, but even the teacher, the prophet, you know, somebody like Jesus or Buddha or Shankaracharya, who are the teachers who become one with God, they also become immortal. You know, 2,000 years after Jesus left His body, you know, we still remember Him. Buddha has been gone for more than 2,500 years. So the teacher and the Lord are both said to be in the north, and we, the students, are in the south. And that's why this is a hymn to the teacher, the Lord, who is Dakshinamurti, who is said to be living in the north and facing the south. We had talked about that last time. And then I had given a brief introduction to who Adi Shankara was. That is the cover. Who is the teacher? Who has actually written this text? So this we had covered last time. If those who were not here, you can read about Adi Shankara on the internet. You can Google his name. Or if you want to listen to my previous talk on this subject or any others, you can go to firstpower.info. So now we shall talk about who is the teacher and who is the student. To whom was this knowledge given and how did this book come to be composed? So here we see the teacher sitting in the middle and there are four students on each side with their palms folded. The picture got a little bit cut off when we downloaded it. But there are four students who are sitting on the floor and the teacher is the Lord Himself. And under His feet is this evil demon that is the ego. So the Lord has overcome ego, while you and me, or the teacher, the Lord or the teacher, the prophet has overcome the ego, while we are still trapped in our ego, in our foolish whims. So what is the story and how did these teachers, how did these students come to learn from this teacher? So I'll give you a little background about Hindu mythology. And it is said God, I think everybody can see this, or if not, maybe you can come on this side. Can you see this poster? If you can come on this side, please. So God is said to have three aspects. Generator, that is the creator. The organizer, the creator who creates us. You know, God creates us. Then the one who takes care of us while we are on this earth. And then the one who takes us away at the time of death. So there is actually only one God, but He has been personified in our scriptures as three aspects. Brahma is the creator. So Brahma is the creator. Vishnu is the Lord of sustenance that takes care of us as we live on this earth. And then Shiva is the God of death or destruction who then takes us when it's time for us to leave. And all three aspects are important. You may say, well, why does God, you know, kill us? Why does He destroy us? But if He didn't, then nobody would ever die. You know, our grandfather, great-great-grand, they would all be living still. There would be no place. The dinosaurs would still be living. If there had been no death, remember they died with a comet that came and struck the earth. The dinosaurs would, we would have not. So death is necessary because it is a creative destruction, because you have to get rid of the old to make way for the new. Now the seed in the tree, in the ground, says, oh, why should this poor seed die? But the seed has to die for the plant to be born. And in the plant, you say there are beautiful flowers. Oh, why do the flowers have to die? But the flower has to die for the fruit to be born. And then the fruit has to be destroyed for the seed to come out. And then that seed has to again be planted in the ground. So there is a constant cycle of birth and death. And all three aspects of the Lord are necessary. We need him to create. We need him to take care of us. And we need him to take us away when it's time for us to leave. So the story goes like this. I shall tell the story. Now, Brahmaji was the creator, and it was the creator who first started creating the world. And the first four children, the men that he created, boys, were born out of his mind. They came out of his thought. He just thought about them, and these four children manifested. And these are these four men, these four men. Now, interestingly, these four young boys who were not at all interested in procreation, the creator thought that he would create these children who would then, I guess, find suitable wives and multiply and continue creation. And they were so spiritual, they said, look, Father, we are not interested in marriage, we are not interested in wives, we want to have the spiritual knowledge. We want to learn about God and about who we are and why this world. And so the creator was very disappointed. He said, oh my God, I made these four children. I thought they would procreate and multiply the human species, and they are not interested. So then, of course, he did again. He created Manu and Shatrupa, what is called as Adam and Eve in the Bible. And then, of course, this Manu and Shatrupa were a man and a woman, and they multiplied, and that's how the human race came, which is the same story in the Bible. But we are not going to talk about this. We're going to talk about these four children who were very spiritual. They wanted to know, who is God? Who am I? Why have I appeared on this earth? What is the nature of creation? And what is the highest truth which will free me from this world of birth and death? And this highest truth is what is given in this particular text, is also given in various other texts, in the Upanishads, in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, which we do every Sunday. We have a class here Sunday from 11 to 12. And also, of course, the same truth has been reproduced in the Bible and the Quran and the Buddha's teachings and the Guru Granth Sahib and all that. So they were interested in this knowledge. So they talked to their father, who taught them as much as they could understand, and they had understood a lot. They had read the scriptures. They were very well versed in the knowledge, but they did not have the final experience. See, in spirituality, you may read all you want, you may study all you want, but there is always a gap between that final knowledge and that experience of becoming one with God, the experience of what we call as God realization, self-realization. And that final step needs the Lord's grace. You may meditate, you may pray, you may do a lot of charity, you may serve the world, you may do everything you can. But human beings are only capable of reaching a particular point. And when your mind becomes completely quiet and becomes ready to accept His grace, in meditation, in prayer, when your mind is supremely silent and becomes ready, then He appears in your mind and draws you up to Him, as if He bends down and lifts you to His bosom, lifts you to His heart. So that final step needs the Lord's grace. Human endeavor can only take you so far. Even in this world, we can see, you know, you may do as much as you want, but unless the Lord's grace is with you, your success is not guaranteed. Yeah, of course, there is a law of karma where what you do, you get the results. But there has to be some, and even in our life, think about it. Everything that we do is because of the Lord's grace. I am moving my hand because I am speaking because He's speaking through me. All of you are listening. He's listening through you. So God's grace is with us constantly. We just don't realize it, we don't recognize it. So these four students, it is said, went out in search of the highest truth. They had studied all the scriptures. They were extremely knowledgeable, but they did not have the final experience. And so it is said that coming down from the heavens, they came down to earth and they came to the Himalayas, where Lord Shiva himself, God, the destructive aspect of the Lord, Lord Shiva is supposed to be very peaceful, very silent, always engaged in meditation. And so this aspect of the Lord was sitting under a tree, sitting in silence in meditation. Here, of course, his eyes are open, but he was sitting in silence, deeply engaged in meditation. So these four students approach him and they bow down and they sit under him in humility. See, the humility is very important. When you want to learn from somebody, knowledge can only flow from higher to a lower, just as water can only flow from higher to a lower. From a lower to a higher, it cannot. So knowledge can flow when we have an attitude of humility, an attitude of respect. See, they have their hands bowed and they are sitting below. And they are asking the teacher for knowledge. And it is said the teacher only gives the knowledge when the student is ready. The student A has to be humble, has to be ready, and has to be receptive. His or her mind has to be open for knowledge to occur. So it is said the Lord gave the knowledge to the four students and answered their questions and gave them the highest knowledge, the realization where they became one with the Lord. But he did not speak a single word. The knowledge was given in absolute silence. The students heard it in silence and the Lord spoke in silence, because the Lord is within us, so he can communicate with us. So in this case, the knowledge was given in silence. And what was the knowledge and how was it given in silence? We shall do in this text. So in page 8, it is said it is meditation verses, which these are the five verses which get us ready to study the book. It is called the Dhyanam. Dhyanam means the invocation of the Lord's grace as we study the book, and it's an introduction. The text itself will start after a few pages, at the next page. So I'll just chant the verses and then give the commentary. Mauna vyakhya prakatita parabrahma tattvam yuvanam varshishthante vasad rishi ganaihi avritam brahma nishthaihi acharyendram karakalit chinmudramananda rupam swatma ramam muditavadanam Dakshinamurti Mide. So the last word is Dakshinamurti Mide. Mide means I worship. I bow down, I salute, I worship who? Dakshinamurti, who is the Lord and who is the teacher. So in our spiritual studies, a teacher who is a realized master, we give him the same rank as the Lord, and that's why we always bow down to the teacher and we touch his feet, recognizing not that you are touching the feet of the human, but recognizing the Lord's presence in the teacher, because the teacher who has become one with God has reached that highest knowledge. So people, for somebody like Buddha or Jesus, like Jesus said, you know, in the Bible, the Father in heaven and I are one. Another place he says, he who hath seen me hath seen the Father. So if you have seen me, you have seen the Lord. So the teacher is a visible expression of the Lord. The Lord himself comes down to earth in the form of the teacher. So here is the teacher who the Lord himself appears in this form. So that teacher I prostrate to, I bow down to, I worship. Now it says, mauna vyakhya prakatita. Mauna vyakhya prakatita. Mauna means silent. Vyakhya means speech. Prakatita means manifested. So he manifested this knowledge in silence. Now, how can anybody speak in silence? That seems very strange. You know, you go to a teacher and you ask a question and the teacher remains silent, and miraculously your doubts are answered. And that is the power of these great rishis. There was a great saint called Raman Maharishi in South India, and he was a realized master, and thousands of people used to come to visit him. He never went around giving talks, talking to people. He just sat in one place, in one temple. And when people would walk by, they would sit in front of him, and his presence was so powerful that people would come with a whole list of questions. You know, I have to ask him this, ask him this, ask him this. And when they would sit in front of him, their questions invariably would be answered. And they would say, I have understood. I have no more questions to ask. Or once in a while, they would ask a question and he may answer or he may not answer. Even when he answered, his answers were so brief that they forced you to look inward and find the answer within. And that is the glory of the teacher, who can make you find the answer yourself. If he spoon feeds you, then that answer will not be your own. It will be his knowledge. But if he encourages you to think and come up with the answer yourself, that is a good teacher. So here he says this teacher spoke in silence. In silence he spoke, and in silence the students understood. And silence has great power. As we know, when you sit for meditation, you know, your mind is running and moving and constantly going. And then through watching your breath, through chanting the name of the Lord, through being a witness, you quieten your mind. And as your mind becomes quiet, in that silence, you feel the Lord's presence within you. A lot of your doubts and questions get answered, and they come spontaneously. The knowledge comes from within. Yes, some of the knowledge comes from the books, but in meditation, when you completely quieten your mind and go inwards, then you feel the Lord's presence within you as energy, as consciousness. And when the mind is completely quiet, then only His presence can be felt. Because our mind is constantly running out into the world of objects, emotions, thoughts, and constantly, you know, stressed out and running and moving. I have this much to do. I have so many things. I have my house to take care of, my children, my job, my club, my social life, my friends, my parents, you know, especially women, you know. You have so many more responsibilities because you're constantly, you know, running around from here to there, and I have no time to do anything. And that's why there is so much stress in this world. Right now you find there is so much disturbed people. You know, there is so much stress, so many conflicts. It is because of mental stress, because of too much, you know, mental problems. So through meditation, you quieten the mind. Through regular practice of meditation, as you do it every day, your mind slowly becomes tame, becomes quiet. And that silent mind, when it is quiet and is not running out into the world, then that mind can be turned inward to the Lord's presence, as signified there by Om. So the Lord is within us. All answers are within us. It is our problem is that we look in the wrong place. We are looking for Him outside. God is outside, but He is also in my heart as my own life, and He is closest to me. And so in meditation, when your mind is silent, then only you experience the highest knowledge. Talking about silence, you know, silence is very powerful. Those of us who are married know, you know, the moment there is a fight between the husband and wife, what happens? Stop talking. And they won't talk, you know, they will be just gesturing, and nobody will talk. And the one who talks first is the loser, right? So there will be silence. So there was this couple who got into a big argument, and they stopped talking. So they won't talk to each other, you know, for a whole day, nothing. He didn't talk, she didn't. he was doing his thing, she was doing her thing, and food was there, he just ate it. Now, next morning, he had to get up early to catch a flight to go. He had to on a business trip. And his wife used to wake up early, and he was in the habit of waking up late, and she always would wake him up early when he had to go on a business trip. So that day, he didn't want to talk, so he left a note on the fridge, "Wake me up at 5 a.m. So he left a note and went to sleep. So the wife saw the note, "Wake me up at 5 a.m. Next morning, the husband overslept, and he was not up till 7, and he got up and said, "Oh my gosh, it's 7 o'clock. I missed my flight." And he was very angry. Of course, in his anger, he forgot that he was not supposed to talk. So he went and started screaming at the wife, "Didn't I tell you to wake me up at 5? And see, I missed my flight." She said, "When did you tell me?" He said, "See, there is this note on the fridge. Didn't you read the note? I left you a note. Wake me up at 5. So she says, "Okay, come here." She takes him to the pillow. On the side of his pillow was a note. "It's 5 a.m. Wake up." She said, "You left me a note. I left you." So anyway, but this teacher taught in silence. And what did he teach? That is the essence of this whole text, of what exactly the teacher taught. Even though the teacher taught in silence, we are grateful to Shankaracharya, who actually put that teaching into this book. So he says, Parabrahma Tattvam. Parabrahma. Brahma means the highest, the Lord himself, the highest Lord. Is called Brahman. That Brahman is the all-pervading, formless consciousness. Para Brahma means it is the highest. Para means it is beyond everything. As we know, God is actually beyond all thoughts, beyond all words, beyond all objects. He cannot be described by speech. He cannot be thought of by the mind or the intellect. Cannot be described. So he is beyond all descriptions. So all the spiritual texts are an attempt to describe the indescribable. And that's why we worship the spiritual texts, because they give us the highest truth. But even they are incapable of giving the highest truth. They can only point us to the direction in which we should contemplate. So it is Parabrahma Tattvam. It is the highest knowledge. Now, the next word is Yuvanam. Yuvanam means he is youthful. In our scriptures, in Hinduism, God is described as always being youthful. In the Bible, he is described as an old man, you know. Old man representing wisdom, that he has all the wisdom. But in our scriptures, God is described as ever youthful, because he is ever creative. Ever and ever new things are happening. New universes are being created, new worlds are being created, new stars are being made, and new planets, and new species, and you know, whatever we know so many billion of species of plants, animals, birds, and fish, and humans. I'm sure there are so many other worlds, and they don't have to have humans that look like us, animals, birds, fish. It could be infinite. It could be ever and ever new. In fact, recently, I don't know if you read about that, bacterium that does not use carbon and phosphorus and uses arsenic to make its body. I think you might have read about that. And so they said, this is something we have never seen before. And all our theories that every creation has to have carbon has been destroyed. Why? Because there is this particular creature that does not use carbon, uses arsenic to make its body and can survive even in arsenic, you know, which is the worst poison. So obviously there are so many other worlds, and there are so many other planets, and there is so much heat and so much cold, and there are, you know, species that live in extreme cold, is minus 30, 40 degrees, and they still can survive. I remember we had gone to Alaska, and it's very interesting. We had taken this plane and was going over the ice cap. And when you go over the ice cap in this little seaplane, nothing but snow, even though it's summer, you know, it was July, it was all snow. And in the middle of that snow, 30, 40 miles away from any water, there is a deer that's running around. Now, who is taking care of that deer? There's 40 miles of, 100 miles of snow all around. And how does that deer get there? And how does that deer survive? Who takes care of that? So that is the glory of this Lord, that he is infinite. You know, his power is infinite. He has infinite abilities. So that's why he is described as Yuvanam. He is youthful, ever energetic, ever young. And that's why this teacher here is shown to be youthful. And the students around it says, Varshishthante Vasat Rishi Ganaihi. These students are rishis. They are renunciates. You know, they are not married because they have these clothes of, these orange clothes of the monks. And they have the beard and they have the clothes. So they are monks. Now these four are, here they have not shown them to be that old, but in the original story, they are described as being much older than the teacher. So the teacher is young, but the students are old. What do we mean by the students are old? It means that the students have acquired a lot of knowledge. They know a lot. They have studied a lot. They have become old and their mind has gotten tired of studying. But they still don't have the final experience. So that is why they are said to be old. Old also means that when you become old, that means you have come to kind of the end of your, you know, resources, your abilities. So here also, they had come to the end of their knowledge, the end of their abilities. They could not accomplish anything more on their own, and that's why they had to approach the teacher or the Lord. Then it says, Ante Vasat. Ante Vasat means indwelling. That means they had studied the knowledge and they understood that the Lord is indwelling. And they had tried to go inwards to get this knowledge. And to a great extent, they had progressed in their spiritual knowledge. It's not that they were, you know, beginners or they, you know, compared to you and me, of course, they had studied so much more. So they were very advanced students and they had understood that the truth is within. But they had not final experience. So, Ante Vasat and Varshishthante means they were elderly. Rishi Ganaihi, so they were four rishis, four monks. Avritam, Avritam means surrounded. So, as we see, the teacher is single and he's surrounded by four students, one on each side of him. Then it says the students are Brahma Nishthaihi. Brahma means the Lord, the highest truth. Nishtha, Nishtha means they had firm faith. So they had firm faith in the Lord and in the teacher. Because unless you have faith in the teaching and faith in the teacher and faith in the Lord, your knowledge can never be complete. And it doesn't matter, doesn't have to be even spiritual knowledge. Say you go to college and you're trying to study mathematics and you are a PhD student. Now the advisor that has been assigned to you, a professor or a PhD, you know, professor. Now you don't like that professor. You don't think he knows anything. You have no faith in him. Then you will never study. You will never learn. You will never be a good mathematics student. Or it could be golf. You know, if you're a golf pro, you don't like him. You're never going to want to study from him. So these four students had firm faith in the teacher, they had faith in the knowledge, and they had faith in Lord. Nishtha also means abidance, that they were completely determined to get this knowledge. See, unless you have that total determination, you can never be successful in any field, even if it's your own business, you start a small business. Unless you have total faith and total determination to succeed, you can never be successful. If you do a part-time job, you know, it's my business, it's okay. Once in a while if I go, if I don't go, it's okay. Then your business will be a failure. Your employees are not going to work. Nobody is going to want to accomplish anything. You have to be there. You have to be driven. And you have to get your employees to buy into your philosophy. Don't they say that? That my employees have to buy into my philosophy. Then only my business will be successful. So a firm determination and a firm desire to succeed had to be there. And that's what these four students had. And so they were very worthy students. They had faith, they had determination, and they approached the teacher with humility and a desire to learn. Acharya Indram. Indram means the Lord, and Acharya means the teacher. So he is the highest of all teachers. As we know, the Lord is the highest, because no matter which teacher I go to, whether I'm studying physics or I'm studying chemistry or I'm studying spirituality or religion or philosophy, all teachers ultimately get their knowledge from the Lord. From who? From God himself. So that's why he is said to be the highest of all teachers, because the Lord is the one who has given the knowledge. Second reason it is called Acharya Indram, because the knowledge of spiritual knowledge or the knowledge of philosophy is said to be the highest knowledge. So the teacher who gives me the knowledge of myself is the highest teacher. You know, you might study physics, or you might study chemistry, or you might study gardening, or you might study tennis, or you might study swimming. Those are all considered as knowledge of the world. But the knowledge that tells me who I am and takes me to that highest spiritual goal is said to be the highest knowledge. In the 10th chapter, the Lord says, out of all the knowledges, I am the spiritual knowledge, a knowledge of the self. So the knowledge of the self is the highest. So the teacher who gives us this knowledge, that's why we respect our spiritual teachers and monks far more than, say, we would respect our chemistry teacher or our biology teacher or our medicine or engineering or, you know, accounting teacher. The spiritual teacher is respected more. Karakalita Chin Mudram. This actually needs a little more explanation. Maybe we'll explain this and then end at this point. Then we can go next week to continuing this verse, or maybe I can finish this verse. It may not take very long. So he says he taught with the chin mudra. Chin mudram karkalit. His hands were in the chin mudra. Now, what is this chin mudra? So those of you who meditate, sometimes you know that we keep our hands in this position also. Now, this posture of the hand has a lot of significance. It's not just a random. And in fact, a lot of people who sit for meditation, they say you should sit like this, you know, with your hands on your knees and with your finger and thumb touching and the other three fingers together. Now, what is the significance of this chin mudra? I'll explain to you. Now, this finger, the pointing finger, we call it as ego. And obviously, because I point, they say to point is very rude, right? Don't they say you should tell your children don't point? It's rude to point. Because say I point at somebody, you, that what it does is it separates me from her. You, the moment I say, or you, that means you and I are separate. So this finger is the ego, and that separates me from everybody else. So that's why pointing is considered as very rude. So this finger is the ego, is the individual, me. Now, when the ego and these three fingers represent the body, the mind, and the intellect. So the body, mind, and the intellect. Also, some people call it as the body, which is the gross body, which you can see. The mind and intellect, which is the subtle body, which we cannot see. And then the vasanas. The vasanas are said to be the causal body. The vasana is what causes me to act. So whatever way you take of it, if you take it as the body, mind, and intellect, so the ego, I at this moment am stuck with just taking care of my body, mind, and intellect. I want to take care of my physical pleasures. I want to take care of my emotional. I must have people I love. I must have everybody around me I love. And then I want to take care of my intellectual success. I want to be very successful. I want to be rich. I want to be powerful. I want to have people who love me. I want to have all the body pleasures and comforts. So the ego is constantly involved in all these three. And that's what we find. Majority of us spend our life only in take caring of our body, mind, and intellect. There are very few people who are spiritually inclined who want to go beyond the body, mind, and intellect to something that is higher, and that is the Lord's presence. Here we have shown it as Om. So the ego, it is right now involved in the body, mind, and intellect. But you leave the body, mind, and intellect. Say, I'm not so much worried about, yes, I have to take care of my health and my body and all, but I'm not going to spend all my life in that. I'm going to turn away from my body, mind, and intellect. Now, where does the ego turn? It turns towards the thumb. Now, what is the thumb? The thumb is the most important part of the hand. Say, if my thumb is cut off, my hand is useless. I cannot do anything, right? I cannot write. I cannot hold objects. I cannot pick up a cup. I cannot even drive. So the thumb is the most important part of the hand. Without the hand is useless. The thumb is used need to write, to cook, to pick up, to operate a screwdriver, anything I want to do, I need the thumb. So the thumb represents God. Just as the thumb is necessary for the hand to function, so God is necessary for me to function in this life. Without His presence, I am useless. So the finger turned away, the ego turned away from the body, mind, and intellect and turned towards God. So that is the significance, that go away from your bodily comforts, turn towards the Lord, and what happens? This finger and thumb make a circle. Now, a circle represents infinity because it has no beginning and no end. When you have a circle, where is the beginning? Where is the end? There is no beginning, there is no end, right? In a circle. So, the circle represents infinity, beginninglessness, endlessness. So, the individual turn towards God becomes infinite, becomes immortal. So that is the significance of this posture. And that's why they say that when you turn your finger towards the thumb, that you're signifying that I am turning away from worldly pleasures and turning my mind towards God. And in that process, I become one with Him. I become immortal. So, Karakalita Chin Mudram Ananda Rupam. And then it says the Lord is of the nature of bliss, which is true. You know, the Lord is all complete, all perfect. He's ever blissful. And we find also in the lives of realized masters, when they become one with the Lord, then they also become blissful. They also become complete. They also become perfect. They also become joyful. And when you approach a spiritual master and you sit with him, you get a little taste of that. So that's why he says he's Ananda Rupam. He's of the form of knowledge. Swatma Ramam. And he experiences the joy within. Swatma Ramam. And it is true. If those of you who meditate, you must have experienced that. That when your mind is very quiet and very peaceful and very silent, then as if waves of joy arise from within. And you know, it's 5 o'clock in the morning and it's dark outside and it's cold, and why are you happy? You know, you're not doing anything, you're not eating anything, you're not watching TV, you're not playing a sport, and still you are happy. Why? Because in the silence of meditation, you experience the inner bliss. And that is why meditation is so beneficial, because you experience the joy within, then you don't need happiness from outside once you have learned how to meditate. So he says, Swatma Ramam, and he experiences the joy from within, and that's why he is Mudit Vadanam. That's why the Lord is ever smiling, ever cheerful, ever happy. And that's what we see the Lord here. The teacher has a smile on his face, representing that he is all bliss, all happiness, all joy. And to that Lord, I prostrate. I bow down. I approach with all humility. That is the essence of the first verse. There is a lot more we could have done, but some of it, the points will be covered in the next few verses. And after we do this introductory verses, the 5, then we will approach the real text. And the text is the essence of the teachings, and it is a very wonderful text. There is a lot that can be learnt. And every verse in these 10 verses, we find gives us different examples and beautiful ways to explain the truth.